Good morning. My name is Christelle, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Women's Veterans SGA conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you, Ms. Lilliston. You may begin your conference.
Good morning, and good early morning for some of you who may be calling us or joining us from the West Coast. My name is Melanie Lilliston, and I am the Director of Technical Assistance and Finance at the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans. Today we're going to be talking about the Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program, the recent SGA that was just announced a couple weeks ago on the homeless women and veterans with dependent children. For those of you, we did send out the materials late yesterday. We do have them also posted on our website, so if you don't have a copy of them and would like to download those, you can go to our website, which is www.nchv.org. On the right-hand side, you'll see a conference call link, and then the materials will come up. I'm going to be going through that presentation. We will also put a link up to the full SGA. And there will be an audio of the call that will be provided most likely Monday, Tuesday at the latest. So if you did have questions and would like to listen to the call again, you will be able to do that. I am going to be giving an overview presentation, a little bit more about the program and go into detail on the general application itself. I will be then answering questions. I'll take as many questions as I can. If for some reason your question does not get answered, I will be able to do that via email or follow up in the next couple of weeks. But majority of the questions that some of you will have will be answered during the call. So if you could just make a note if you do have a question, and I can address those at the conclusion of the call. We should have plenty of time for questions. With that, we're going to go ahead and get started. As I said, you can follow along through the materials that are posted on our website or that were sent to you via email. Today we are going to be talking about the Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program, the Homeless Women and Veterans with Dependent Children SGA. This is a specific HVRP grant that is targeting women and homeless women and veterans with dependent children. Going to get into just some general overview of the program, and then some of the application, and then some very specifics for this particular application. It's important to keep in mind that the HVRP program has two specific objectives. This program is offered through the Department of Labor, so it is going to have objectives tied to employment. So everything that you're going to be doing is going to be centered around removing the barriers of employment. The overall objectives for this program are to ensure services to assist in reintegrating the homeless veterans into meaningful employment within the labor force, and to stimulate the development of effective service delivery systems that will address the complex problems facing homeless veterans. These are very important because as you think about who would be appropriate and the different clientele that you will be serving, employment is the ultimate outcome, meaning that this program is not going to be suited for everyone, because not everyone, not all veterans that may enter your program will be looking for long-term full-time employment. So you must keep in mind the population that you're looking at, and the ultimate goal is full-time employment. The program year for this particular grant starts July 1st, 2010, and will run through June 30th, 2011. The reason this is important is because the due date of this application is May 27th. Originally, it was posted as the 26th, but it has been revised in grants.gov to the 27th. But what that means is that there will probably not be that much turnaround time from when you were notified that your grant has been funded and when your program must start. This is very important because you do have certain performance goals and objectives that must be put into place, and if you start behind the curve, it's very hard to catch up. We'll go into that a little bit more, but this program is really set up for organizations and programs that are working with veterans at this particular time or will be able to get up and running most likely at a maximum of 2 to 3 weeks because of the quick turnaround time that is needed. You will be notified, and you could be notified up to as late as June 30th as a start time for your program, and you will be working in conjunction with Department of Labor staff for that. But it does run June 1st. I'm sorry, the program starts July 1st and will run through June 30th. It's 1 year of funding with two optional years of renewal funding, which means as long as you meet your goals and objectives and are able to produce what you're needed to underneath those common measures, you will be funded if you continue to get funding for one and possibly two additional years if appropriations are there. There is a total of $5 million available underneath this particular SGA. And up to $3 million is available underneath the urban, and those awards will range $75,000 to $300,000. The minimum is $75,000. The maximum that you can apply for underneath the urban is $300,000. There is also up to $3 million available for non-urban. The awards will range from $75,000 to $200,000. And these programs and these grants will specifically focus on female veterans and or homeless veterans with families. So the total that will be awarded will be $5 million with up to $3 million in each category. The different categories are based on the population of your city. So urban is the 75 most populated cities, and these are listed in one of the appendices, Appendix G, for all of the cities. And essentially, if you have equal to or more than around 569,000 in your population. And what I will say is that this is the population you will be serving. Your program might be in County A. Physically, your address is in County A, but you will be serving veterans in County B. So it's based on the program where you'll be serving veterans, so it's important to keep that in mind. Non-urban are sites that are not listed as the 75. So if you're not listed on that Appendix G, you are considered non-urban. You can only apply for one portion. So if you're serving both urban and non-urban, you would apply underneath the non-urban grant. In order to be urban, you must just be serving that population only on those 75 cities. You must also indicate which category you are applying for. Most organizations will include a map, a geographic, something along those lines that will show exactly what areas you'll be serving, and that will determine and will let the staff reading the applications know which areas you will be serving with your program. One of the main differences or one of the different adages of this particular SGA are the special linkages that you must have in place in order to effectively deal with the homeless females and the veterans with families. On slide 5 here, I've listed these. They come straight from the SGA, but it's important that you keep in mind that everything is going to tie back to the female veteran and the veterans with dependent children. So you must demonstrate connection to transitional housing for female and or homeless veterans with dependent children. These housing needs are going to be different than a single veteran that might be coming into your program. So you must have those connections either through HHS, HUD, affordable housing, wherever it may be. You must have connections for that female and or the veteran with families. You must demonstrate that you have experience in serving homeless veterans and be able to provide family counseling and youth development services. In this particular SGA, we're not just talking about services for veterans. We're talking about services that would go to the veteran that would be a benefit of the family. So a family is going to be a integral part of the services you need to offer. So family counseling, youth services, all of those things need to be addressed because some of those obviously are going to be large barriers to employment. You're also going to have the linkages to the mental health, primary care, substance abuse treatment, access to pediatric care since you're dealing with families, sexual trauma therapy. A large majority of female veterans have undergone some sort of sexual trauma, so it is important that you're able to address and help them through those types of issues. PTSD and any other health-related services. Most of the programs that have been running before that have typically been HVRP programs have been serving males. Females obviously are going to have different set of primary care health needs, and so having access to those or linkages to those are very important. Now, those can come from the VA, but you must show that you have access to those female-specific and or family-specific services for those veterans. Also, advocacy for veterans to apply for benefits. Do you have someone who can help fill out those benefits, deal with some of the things that come with that, as well as some of the mainstream services, food stamps, all of those types of things. Child care and or aftercare support for veterans with families. If you're dealing with veterans with families, you obviously are going to have to deal with the child care issue. Who is going to provide that child care? How is it going to be paid for? How is it going to be offered to the veterans as they go through your program? So thinking through that and really evaluating going through the process to determine how and what is going to be offered is critical, as well as any community resources. This is the first time that they've done a SGA for female veterans, and one of the big things that I have a feeling is really going to come out is some of the community resources that might be available within your community. So really think about and look through what services are currently available for families and or females in your community, and really partner and think about how you can offer those services or access to those services without duplicating them within your program. Now, as we look forward for the program design, this program obviously is going to provide comprehensive services, and it's going to be client-centered case management. You're going to use both federal, state, and local resources, so it's a combination of those, and the services are going to be customized based on the needs of the individuals. So you must have clear strategies and obtainable goals for your training, employment placement, and retention of employment. Everything is going back to removing those barriers for employment. You must be flexible to the local needs and meet the complex needs of veterans. So what this really refers to, if you live in perhaps a rural area, what makes sense for you to think about when it comes to job training, those types of things? Where are the jobs in your community? Maybe you have a large agricultural area, so you might think about how and what we can use to vitalize that. You want to make sure that the training that you're offering will eventually lead to employment, and it must be specific to your community's needs. You must demonstrate the capacity to partner with workforce investment board programs and other agencies to develop jobs. There are current programs within your community as well as through the Department of Labor that are working on job development, but you will have to and are expected to participate in that as well in the job development process. And you are responsible for participating in a stand-down event. Now, this does not mean that you have to host the stand down. It just means that you must participate. For those of you who may not know, a stand down is a 1 to 3 day event that brings all of the services and resources a veteran may need to one specific location, provides those services to the veteran, employment being one of them, and as well as health care, those types of things. You are not, as I mentioned, if you look at slide 7 there, grantees and subgrantees are responsible for participating in the stand-down event. You must apply, and you are able to apply separately for funding for the Department of Labor for stand-downs. You can receive up to $10,000 for a 3-day event to offset some of your costs. But none of the money that you have in your budget can be allocated to the stand down. All of the money that you use to host or run a stand down must come through the Department of Labor stand down grant. So that's important there. And there's also a link for that. So if you are participating in a stand down and are not getting money from the Department of Labor, that's the link that you need to apply and get more information on. All right. So one of the things that we need to think about or talk about is the scope of the program design. We talked a little bit about what should be offered, but really what is included with those services. So we're talking about outreach, intake, and pre-enrollment assessment, job placement services, job training, be that on-the-job training, compensated work therapy, licensing, credentialing, whatever may come into place for your specific program. Referrals to employment services, job search, workshops, resume writing, all of those things come into play. Specifically, coordination with other veteran service programs, DVOPs, leavers, continuums of care, grant and per diem programs, as well as veteran service organizations. The key here is you do not want to duplicate what's already being done within your community. So if you have a great referral system with your veteran service organizations, they'll help with benefits, applications, those types of things. Partner with them, show that you have an MOU, and really use that as a benefit for your organization to be able to serve the population within this grant. You must also provide referrals to healthcare, counseling, and rehab services, specifically, once again, to the homeless female veterans and veterans with families, and then any other supportive services that might expedite the reintegration of homelessness into the labor force. Once again, removing those barriers that will essentially ensure that a homeless veteran will be able to get a job. And obviously, most important is the referrals to housing assistance. It's very difficult to get a job and keep a job if you do not have proper housing. So housing is vital. You cannot pay for housing services underneath the HVRP grant. It is only for services. However, you must be linked to housing in order to receive funding from the Department of Labor. Now, the two big kind of participant goals that you must have here, we're going to talk about in a few minutes, but it's very important that you know that when we're talking about employment training and those types of things, that at least 80% of your enrolled participants must participate in formal training activities. Now, this means remedial education on the job, classroom training, vocational, all of the things that would be specific and formal during class hours. There's a sign-in, there's a sign-out sheet, there are certain curriculums, there's a formal schedule, all of those things, formal training. While required, they do not count towards your 80%. Basic life skills and money management are required, but they do not count towards your 80%. So keep that in mind as you move forward. There are two primary outcome measures for the HVRP grant. The first is the entered enrollment rate, and the second is the retention following placement. I'm going to go through these in a little bit of detail, but specifically these are going to be what you're going to be tracked, and you're going to have to make sure that you are following as you move forward and what you'll be graded on as your grant is looked at. Entered enrollment must be a minimum of 66%, and your retention must be a minimum of 65%. These are very high percentages, especially with the population that we're working with. So it's important that you know this going in. If this is not something that you think your organization can feasibly follow, you must. It may not be a good idea for you to be able to do that, to apply for those types of funding. So in order to calculate your entered enrollment rate, it is the number of participants who enter employment, those who are employed after 90 days, divided by the number of participants who have exited the program. The definitions of both participants who enter enrollment and those who have exited the program are included in the SGA, but this is how you're going to determine who is listed in there and how it's going to affect that percentage. The second is the retention following placement. It's the number of participants who entered enrollment, who entered employment and who are still employed 180 and 270 days after their placement, divided by the total number of participants who entered employment. So this is the long term. Are those people who you gave jobs still able to have those jobs and maintain them in a long-term basis? So it's not just that we're looking at are you able to get individual jobs. They're also looking at are you able to help them keep those jobs on a long-term basis. This is a results-oriented model, employment being the major outcome that they're looking at. However, there is no program model that is mandatory, but you must be responsive to the needs of the veterans in your community as well as meeting the HVRP objectives. Your program should include at a minimum, these are listed on slide 13, outreach, assessment, referrals, enrollment, development of individual employment plans, participate in training and supportive services, entry into full-time employment, and follow-up. You must address all of these as you're going through because it's important to know that how you're going to work and assess the needs of the individuals in these programs. As with any federal grant, there are reporting requirements. This particular grant uses common measures, which means you are going to track all your outcomes and participant activities through this particular process. You do have quarterly technical assistance reports, and you must follow up with the participants 90, 100, and 270 days after the participants enter employment. So keep in mind that this is a 12-month grant. However, if you enroll someone in the 11th month of this grant, you are going to have to follow up with them 90, 180, and 270 days after they are entered into employment, which means that you will be providing services even though your program is officially over on paper. You can budget some of those dollars ahead, but keep in mind that you are responsible for following up with those individuals in those time frames, and you will be graded on your success to be able to do that. So that's the general kind of program overview, what they're looking for, some of the outcomes that are there, kind of a brief overview of does this program make sense or is this something that would make sense within our current program design. Now I'm going to go through the grant part of the application, specifically talking about how to fill it out, who's eligible, the different parts of it, and how to assemble the actual application, and then we'll go through some questions and answers. So starting on slide 16 here, in order to be an eligible HVRP applicant, you must be a state and local workforce investment board, a public agency, which includes, county, state, and or city levels of funding, a for-profit or commercial entity, or a nonprofit organization, including faith-based and community organizations. So you must fall into one of these categories. If for some reason you don't, you can partner with an organization who does fall into one of these categories. However, they would be the funded agency. As I mentioned, the grants are competitively awarded and awarded annually based on available of funding with 2 years of additional funding if you are able to meet your reporting requirements and if appropriations are given to this program. So it can in turn up to be a 3-year grant as long as you're able to meet those goals and objectives. There are several ways that you can submit this application. One is online through grants.gov. You can go and make sure that you do have to have a passcode. You do have to have some information verified before you can do that. So I would encourage you to go ahead and get that done now so there isn't any issues or log-on issues in the future. There are certain formats that are acceptable. These are included on slide 17. Typically, your documents, your PDFs, or your text files are what will be uploaded. If you do not choose to use grants.gov, you can submit a hard copy to the office here in D.C. However, it must be received by the due date, no exceptions. So as I suggest, send it FedEx certified so that it will be received. Do not send it regular mail because it will not get here on time. Mail that goes to D.C., especially a federal office, has to be screened and it takes additional time. So send it via FedEx or other some sort of verified carrier so someone does have to sign for it and you do have proof it was delivered. For the hard copies, it must be mailed or hand-delivered. Make sure you get confirmation of that. You must have one original signed in blue ink and 2 copies of the cover letter, the executive summary, the technical proposal, and the cost proposal. I'm going to go through those in a few minutes, but those are the different sections. So you're going to have three copies. One is an original and 2 copies. It is suggested that you use tabs and or dividers to show the 3 different sections and to have your to have your cover letter on top of it. So there will be three bundles, if you will, that will have identical things. Just one will be an original and two will be copies of the same document. As I mentioned, there are three parts to an application. The executive summary is 1 to 2 pages. The technical proposal is not to exceed NTE 15 pages. And the cost proposal, there is no limit stated, but that is simply filling out some forms and a couple narratives based on what they are requesting. The total application cannot exceed 75 single space pages in 12-point font with one-end margins. So it's very important that you look and you know what's included in those pages. Attachments are included in the 75 maximum, and major subsections and major sections and subsections must be divided and clearly identified within there. So you should have a tab for both your executive summary, your technical proposal, and your cost proposal. There should be different sections there so it's clearly identifiable to the reader that it is there. Once again, you're going to have an original signed in blue ink, and two copies of each section are required. The executive summary reflects the grantee's overall strategy. I always suggest that people write this at the conclusion or the last thing that they do. It's an overall summary, meaning this will encapsulate or give a brief overview of what you're going to be doing, which area you're going to be serving, any experiences that you may have in providing services to residents or veterans in your community, how you're going to work your strategy for your program design, your methods of your projects, and the schedules that you're going to address, as well as the descriptions of your measures of success for the plan. So the executive summary will give a reader a very good overview of what they're going to see in detail in the following pages. So as I say, I suggest that a lot of people write this out after they finish their technical proposal, so that way they can have a clear idea of what they have written and how they would like to present that. The technical proposal listed here on page slide 21, these are the sections that you must include. These are listed in the SGA, starting, I think it's on page 10 of the SGA. It gives specific overview of what must be included there. The need for the program. Why is this program needed in your community? Use statistics, some research. What are the numbers of veterans in your community? How is that going to help them? Talk about your approach or the strategy to increase employment and job retention. How are you going to get them jobs and keep them jobs within your community? Linkages with facilities that serve homeless veterans. If they're current transitional housing facilities, grant per diem programs, anything that might be helping veterans currently, how are you going to work with them, both federal, state, and local community organizations? Leakages with other providers of employment and training services to homeless veterans. So this is where you're going to talk about your Department of Labor, your employment services, all of the things that come into place, your DVOPs, your leavers, everything that comes that is already being served within your community. Any linkages with federal agencies, proposed supportive services strategy for veterans, what types of services, how are you going to provide housing services, or how are you going to provide the PTSD or the sexual trauma that the trainings that they need, really linking them to what's already there. Your organizational capacity to provide required program activities, why is your organization the best one to serve veterans in your area? The measures of success will tie back to those the measures of success will tie back to your common measures, but also what other things are you going to be doing within your program to ensure your evaluation is proper and that you're able to meet those goals and objectives. Sustainability, how will you be looking to fund this program in the future if you are not awarded additional dollars in upcoming years? Your proposed housing strategy for homeless veterans, as I mentioned, in this particular SGA, we're talking about females and veterans with dependent children, meaning your strategy for housing is going to be or possibly could be a little bit different than the current population that you're working with. And then green jobs, how are you going to address that and how are you going to look at and track that within your job development and training activities? So each one of those sections must be addressed, and there should be a header for each one of these different subsections within your application. The cost proposal listed there on slide 22. These are all the things that are included here. It's your application for federal assistance, which is a standard form 424, your budget information sheet, which is a standard form 424A, your budget narrative, your assurances and certification pages, your financial audits within the last 18 months, you must include that information. You must include any employment and training grants that you've had in the past 3 years. And include the appendices for the surveys ensuring equal opportunity for applicants, and then any indirect or charges or certificates of direct deposits, which is Appendix I. So Appendix A is the 424. You must sign it. Keep in mind that there are no matching requirements required, but they are encouraged if you do have funds from additional source. Your maximum is either $200,000 for the non-urban or $300,000 for the urban. So your costs are fairly low dollar amounts that you can request. The 424, which is Appendix B, these are the different categories that you must fill in. And these, obviously, your budget is going to have more intensive categories, but these are the ones that the Department of Labor wants you to take a look at. Fringe benefits. These cannot exceed 35% of salary and wages. Travel, which should include two individuals to attend a national training, usually hosted in D.C. Depending on where it is, I would budget for D.C. for a week for two individuals, and then local mileage if you have staff that does travel. Equipment cannot exceed $5,000 per unit. Supplies, we're talking about general office supplies, those types of things. Any contractual, do you off-site training, do you work or subcontract anything there? And then the other category addresses your matching funds, your leverage funds, and in-kind donations, those types of things. Keep in mind administrative costs include both direct and indirect costs associated with the supervision and management of the program. So if you have someone who enters data within your program or someone who supervises staff, those types of things, that would be considered administrative costs. And it cannot exceed 20% of your total grant award. So make sure that you do fall within those categories. So that is your cost proposal. The HVRP application criteria, so this gives you the overall point status and how many points you can get for each particular category. The need is 10 points. Your ability to determine or give the accuracy of need is 10 points. Your overall strategy to increase employment and retention employment is 40 points. You can receive up to 10 additional points if your strategy includes innovative approaches for addressing barriers faced by female veterans and or homeless veterans with families. So in this instance, you can receive up to 50 points, especially if you're addressing the needs of female veterans and veterans with dependent children. Quality and extent of linkages with other providers. Are you working with or do you have contact with all the variety of services or the variety of providers within your community? And do they know you and are they willing to work with you? Do you have a demonstrated capacity in providing required program services, reporting, tracking? How are you going to put those things into place and make sure that you're doing what you say you're going to do? And then your overall quality of your overall housing strategy is 10 points. So key notes on the budgets, you must plan and obligate funds in the budget for follow-up. As I mentioned before, you must follow up with these individuals for 90, 180, and 270 days after the grant expiration to track and make sure that they have retained that employment. So you can budget for those, and they should be included in your financial tracking, how you're going to do that and how you're going to pay for that. So you can allocate some of those dollars as long as you do it now when you're submitting your application. So specifically for this grant, some important reminders to include. In order to be eligible for this program, a veteran, a person must be homeless and a veteran and or a veteran with families. Now, the definition of homeless is a person who lacks a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence. It includes shelters, institutions, and places not meant for regular sleeping accommodations. It does not mean I don't have somewhere to stay, I'm going to go stay at my friend Steve's house. I'm not considered homeless underneath this program, and I would not be eligible for it. So you must be homeless in order to be eligible. You also must be a veteran, a person who served in active military and who was not discharged or released under conditions other than dishonorable. Or you must be a veteran with a family. So you must meet the definition of veteran. And a veteran with a family is a person who is a veteran and is the primary caregiver of any independent children under the ages of 18. So you must be a veteran and you must be homeless in order to be eligible for the services of the HVRP grant. You can only submit one application per organization. If you are a current HVRP grantee, you can submit underneath this grant. Your target population just must be different than who you are currently serving. You can't have individuals enrolled in two different HVRP programs, so you must serve a separate population than ones that you're currently serving. You must include or participate with the Disabled Veterans Outreach Program or LEVER staff. It's very important that you link with these Department of Labor staffers at your one-stop employment centers because they will provide and give you assistance in finding employment for veterans. Work with organizations or programs that are familiar with the complex needs of homeless veterans. Veterans do have and require extensive specialized services, so it's important that you know going in that you are going to have specific services that are going to be needed by those veterans. Once again, this is an employment-focused program, and you must help veterans get and maintain long-term meaningful employment. So we're not talking minimum wage in most instances. These job placements are well above minimum wage, and we're talking about long-term employment for these individuals. It is a very highly competitive grant with very high outcomes. As I mentioned, your intern employment and your retentions are in the mid-60s, so those are the minimums, whereas most organizations do have and are successfully much higher than that. The minimum score is 70, but competitive rate is usually much higher for the grant scores. The national average, and these are based on the general HVRP grants, so your services for women and veterans with families may be a little bit higher, but just to give you a rough idea, the average cost for placement last year was around $2,500, and so as I mentioned, you know, it should be fairly close to that. We know that female veterans and veterans with dependent children do have and often require extensive services, so that cost may be a little bit higher in your area. As I mentioned, the program will be awarded no later than June 30th. However, the program will start July 1st. And you must attend and budget for the post-award conference in late July, early August. I know I've covered a lot of different information, but at this point we have about 20 minutes or so to answer any questions that you may have. If we could have everybody start with questions, we'll go through, start with one question, and then if we have time we can cycle back through them. But if you do have questions, we will take those now as we go through.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. We will pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Vivian Bush.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I was curious, early on you said that the 80% training requirement mm-hmm. did not include life skills and money management.
That's
we have a current HVRP grant, and we have the TPR, the Common Measures spreadsheet that we work with. And on that spreadsheet, life skills and money management is included under the training. And we have, in fact, been using that as part of our 80% training requirement. Is this a change?
It is a change, yes.
Okay, so is it
that grant will continue the way it is? Yeah, that grant will continue the way it is under this particular program. It is a change.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Your next question comes from the line of Michael Brown.
Hello. I got a couple of real quick ones. One, can the goals be modified after 1 year? since we haven't worked with strictly the homeless females and the veterans with families, we're not 100% positive. We have 10 years in HVRP, but we haven't worked with just this population. And it'll be modified after 1 year.
Yeah, you'll have to work with your local, vet's office to do that. It is a possibility, and it can be done. I'm not sure how simple that would be, but there is a possibility that that can be done, yes.
And the other one was you talked about mixing areas. We have a kind of a strange area where we are near Albany, New York, where we have counties that are part of the metropolitan area, counties that aren't in between. It's kind of a funky area. You cannot mix an urban county in a non-urban county.
You can. You would just be considered a non-urban grant.
Even though we're taking a lot of the urban area.
Yes, that's correct. If you're serving an urban area, it has to be strictly one of those 75 cities.
Okay.
And if you're serving a combination, it has to be, it's considered non-urban.
Okay.
That was my understanding from them. To be considered urban, you have to strictly fall in that 75 city.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Your next question comes from the line of Diane West.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
At slide 24, on the budget, on on-the-job training, and let's see. Training services. You know, they have like CWT, supportive employment with the VA.
Mm-hmm.
Could we use the money to pay for that?
Within the CWT program?
Yes, to pay the women's salaries for like, say, 2 months or something.
What usually happens, and I'll tell you, I don't know what they'll say about that. Usually what happens is that you work in conjunction with that program and that you refer them to CWT and they do that part of the training.
But
usually it's not paid for underneath this program.
What if it's in the community?
Then that's something that could be, it would be contractual out. The key thing here is that you wouldn't be paying the veteran directly. You'd be paying an organization that would be doing on-the-job, or if your organization is doing on-the-job training, the money would then come from them to the veteran. You're not going to be paying the veteran directly.
All right, but we could pay the VA for that, and they'd pay the client?
Honestly, you might be able to do that, but in most instances with the VA, the person is not, the organization does not pay for CWT. It's covered by the VA.
I understand, but I said, is it possible to do that?
You can put it in and see what they say. I don't know one way or the other.
Okay. And one other question. I applied for a WANTO grant for the women in apprenticeships and non-traditional occupations. I really don't think I'm going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
But say I do, and they could those jobs go in both grants? I mean, so say something.
Where is that? Where is that funding coming from?
Department of Labor.
Yeah, you're going to have to be really careful because you can't be funded for same activities under same grants.
Right, that's what I was wondering. Okay.
Yeah, so if they're paying for the same thing or would be paying for the same services or the same trainings, no, you wouldn't be able to enroll them in both. So you're going to have to be really careful about that.
Okay, and then, so say you get $3,000 per placement and you go with, say, 30 women. So then you have to get placed at least, say, around 20 in the jobs to meet the 66%?
That's correct.
Okay. And so it's about the jobs, not the – so what if you place all your people in the 11th month? Does it still meet it?
Well, I would suggest that you take a look at the common measures technical assistance guide that's there. It'll break that down for you. You're reporting your requirements quarterly.
Right.
So if you're not meeting your goals and objectives quarterly, you're going to get called out and they're going to come in and look at your program. So, no, you would have to be meeting those goals and objectives pretty much throughout the year.
But like, say, CNA training might take 12 weeks, 3 months to 5 months. And so they don't start working until the 6th month.
Right, but you're not going to be having everyone coming in at that particular. It's going to take time for them to come in. So, like I said, take a look at those. Take a look at that technical assistance guide for the common measures, and that should answer most of your questions on that.
Okay, thank you.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Your next question comes from the line of Stephen Bolton.
Yes, I'm just wondering if there's any, is there any reason that we could not include funds for child care or housing in our budget?
No, but what I will tell you, housing, no, you cannot do housing. Housing is not allowed.
Okay, so no housing. In other words, we have to have an arrangement. Part of what I'm thinking about is maybe including some funds for another agency that provides child care in the budget.
Right, and that's what I said. That's what I'm suggesting to organizations. Once again, you don't want, if you're doing vouchers, or you don't want to say to a veteran, "Here's $50, go get child care." No, that's not what we're talking about. In your instance, it would be, okay, we're going to partner with maybe a local HHS program that already has a child care system. Maybe you'll offset some of the cost of that, or you'll work with a veteran to do that. But the money would be going, or the voucher would be going directly to the program and be a benefit of the veteran. But the veteran wouldn't be getting the cash. Yeah.
Okay.
That's the thing. They don't want the cash or, you know, the money to go directly to the veteran, because it seems like, you know, that would be too much of an incentive for them.
Right.
Yeah, that's the ideal situation, is that you would partner with someone that would be able to provide the child care maybe at cost or a little bit less cost, or they would have a program that would be offering child care, and you could utilize that with your women or families.
Okay. And on page 8, when you're talking about coordinating with other veteran serving programs, the DVOPS, LIVERS, COC, mm-hmm. GPD, does that mean grant per diem?
That's correct, grant per diem through the VA.
Okay, mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Dawana Jones.
Hello, this is McVett. There are several things that is not covered, and that is dealing with veterans with records. So you can train them all you want, but if they've got a record or issues with the law, nobody's going to hire them.
Right,
and
but
I'm
you can
suggesting,
use them.
And I have suggested that before these grants and things put out, that these areas be defined, because you're spending money that you'll never get people hired for.
Well, that's part of the assessment. The general assessment is determining what barriers are there. Funds can be used to remove some of those legal issues and assist them with that. But one of the assessments that you would do before you perhaps would enroll them would be to find out what type of legal barriers they are encountering.
Okay, and my second issue has to deal with the definition of homelessness. All of your services that support housing and education and health care have different meanings for homelessness. And if you're going to include female with children, and you define homelessness as a person without an address, for a person to access social services or put their kids in school, they have to have an address. And the moment they get that, they're not eligible. So
it has
to be worked out.
Eligible when you're enrolled. So when that person is enrolled, then they, as long as they're homeless when they're enrolled, they are fine. If you enroll them and the next day they are able to access housing, they were homeless when they were enrolled in the HVRP program, and that's what matters to the enrollment.
Can you take this?
But the problem is that they were. Your definition says that anyone who's in a shelter is not eligible because they're not homeless. You also say that person living with friends or family are not eligible. Only persons who are living in places that are unfit for human habitation, in cars, under bridges, in lean-tos or tents, are the only ones that are eligible. Well, the people that we would be accessing, if we are an agency with a fixed structure in terms of providing a shelter for someone, does that mean that we're not eligible even the day before they enroll?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. You do some sort of assessment when they come in or when they're referred to your program?
Yes.
Before they may be placed into your program?
Well, they yes, but
okay.
They're living somewhere else. If they're homeless.
Okay, well, I'm not going to, okay, I'm going to tell you right now, because this conversation, sir, please.
Or your family,
sir,
if your name is not on the lease, then you're homeless. But
well,
your
I'm
definition
following,
says if you're living with friends or family, you're not eligible.
Okay, I'm gonna say this, and I'm happy to have the discussion with you offline, but what
okay.
I'm going to tell you is that this is the definition that the Department of Labor uses. In order to be eligible for this program, you must be homeless when you are enrolled in that. You have to meet that definition. There is no way around it. It's not my definition. It's the federal law. So my suggestion is when you have individuals who are – most programs, when someone comes in either from the street or wherever it may be, they there's an assessment that is done with them. If they are considered homeless at that point under that definition, then you can enroll them. If you refer them there one day, that's fine. What some programs have done, and I'm very familiar with McVet, and I know you guys have a great system up there, but what some have done is, because shelters are included, is reserving them a bed in the shelter for one evening. They are considered homeless. It's not the greatest thing in the world. I understand that, but then there is no concern that that individual is not homeless when they're enrolled in the program. So I'm happy to continue the discussion offline. However, I don't want other people to get confused with all the nuances, because yes, each program is going to have a different definition of homelessness. For this particular grant, you must be homeless underneath that definition when you are enrolled. So that's just the way it is. Like I said, it's not my preference. It's the Department of Labor law that set up the program.
Understood. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Karen Kratz.
Yes, hello. I would like to clarify the cost of housing issue. The agency that I represent is operates transitional housing and emergency and transitional housing for homeless people. And so what actual part can we use under the grant? Like if we have a case manager or an employment specialist, can that be paid for under the grant?
As long as it's not being paid for underneath another funding source. You can't
okay.
double dip. So if you have specific employment services that may not be covered by your program currently and you would like them to be covered underneath the HVRP, yes, that's fine. But if a case manager is already being covered 100% underneath another grant, you can't ask for Department of Labor to pay for twice that person's one salary.
Okay. So anything like utilities that would be specific to the housing could not be included?
No. Mm-mm. Nothing tied to housing can be covered. So
okay.
you're talking about services only. This
okay.
is a service only, and it's employment services only.
Employment services only. So even case management couldn't be covered?
Well, if they're working with an individual to remove some of those barriers, then yes, but it has to be tied back to that employment piece.
Okay.
So if you have someone that may be working on four or five, I mean, when an individual has case manager, not all of it is considered, you know, personal life skills, those types of things. Some of it might be employment focused.
Mm-hmm.
So that portion of it could be, but if it's just general, you know, I need to do or just general what's going on with you, no, that's not.
Okay. Thank you.
I mean, it's pretty broad, but you have to always be able to tie it back to one of those barriers of employment.
Well, even like substance abuse or something like that?
It can be, but like I said, you just want to be clear within your program design that it can always be tied back to removing the barriers to employment.
Yeah. We have general case managers, and everything's tied to ending their homelessness, which you could say is a barrier to employment. So would that wouldn't work?
It could, but you underneath this program, so you'd have that A program. If people are enrolled in B program, which would be the HVRP, you might want to change your outcomes to finding housing and employment. So that way there wouldn't be a question of what's going on within that program.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. We have time for a couple more questions, and then I want to be cognizant of everyone's time. We are getting close to 1 hour.
Your next question comes from the line of Janet Stringfellow.
Hi. We're very excited about a grant opportunity like this, which is specific for homeless female veterans. But if the grant is not going to cover for things like childcare or aftercare support, what will be the main features that will distinguish this opportunity from your regular HBRP?
It can cover child care, and it can,
oh.
I don't know what the second thing you said was, but it can cover some of those things specific to the female and the family with veterans. That's why this grant is being offered.
Okay. Anything else that it wouldn't be covering the regular HVRP?
Housing is the big thing. That's never covered in HVRP is housing. So it still is not covered here.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You have a follow-up question from Steve Bolton.
I just wanted to clarify, a female veteran or veteran with children that are staying in a homeless shelter are considered homeless and are eligible, right?
Yes, that's a shelter, yes.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have one more question, perhaps?
You have one last question from Diane West.
Okay. I'm asking, homeless men, veterans, do they have to have custody of their children, or can they be non-custodial fathers?
It's the guardian of, if you look at the definition, it's the guardian of, they would have to be the legal guardian.
Oh, it could be both parents. I've been getting more and more families.
That's fine, yeah, but one of them would have to be a veteran.
Right. So if the woman was a veteran, could we help the man? Probably not.
Well, you could help her, and he would benefit as help from her.
Okay. And the other thing, you talk about child care, what about like PTSD treatment or, say, youth activities? Could we use some money to have for the youth for this?
I would be very careful with that. They, from what I've heard, this is the first time it's been offered. It is possible that they will allow it. However, I wouldn't go crazy with having, you know, a large portion of your dollars to do that. I think it will be allowed within moderation, but you always want to be able to link back the benefit to the veteran themselves. If you can have the benefit to the veteran, help them remove that barrier to employment, that's fine. But I wouldn't spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on teen activities because your dollar should be sent somewhere else.
And what about the family therapy? Could it pay for that?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, well, I think we're going to go ahead and stop there. Hopefully this provided some answers for you. Keep in mind that, yes, those types of services, those specific services offered to either veterans or veterans with dependent children are what is being covered here and what can be allowed. Anything that will remove those barriers to employment are exactly what this is looking for. Housing is not something that can be covered underneath an HVRP grant regardless. So no housing costs, but your PTSD, your legal services, family counseling, youth services, child care, all of those things are allowed underneath this grant because you are serving a veteran and a veteran with dependent children. So those are things that can be covered. I would just, you know, keep cognizant that you don't have that much money and try to partner with other agencies as much as possible to offset some of those costs. If you have more specific questions or want to follow up with me, you can give me a call at 202-546-1969, or you can give me an email at mlillison@nchv.org. Once again, it's mlillison@nchv.org. I want to thank everybody for their time, and please let me know if you do have any other additional questions. But best of luck on your applications. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.